KCRW sponsors include Disney, presenting Young Woman and the Sea, an incredible true story from producer Jerry Bruckheimer and starring Daisy Ridley, now playing in select theaters.
KCRW's car donation program is sponsored by local Kia dealers. Introducing the all-new EV6 with a vehicle-to-load function that turns the EV6 into a mobile power source. More info at kia.com.
From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business. Filmmaker Jane Schoenbrunn's first feature, We're All Going to the World's Fair, premiered to critical acclaim at Sundance in 2021. The filmmaker capitalized on the moment to set up their next project, with Emma Stone and husband Dave McCary producing.
I guess I've learned in the industry it's called like a competitive situation, in that multiple people are sort of vying to do it. So you've got some heat behind you, and that obviously allows you to negotiate. In my case, that was like very much about like negotiating for creative autonomy.
Jane Schoenbrunn talks about how growing up in the suburbs was the inspiration for the sinister setting in their A24-backed film, I Saw the TV Glow. The filmmaker also shares why the nuances of gender and identity play a major role in their work, and how they realized they were trans after taking a mushroom trip with friends. But first we banter. Stick around. It's The Business from KCRW. I'm joined by my partner in banter, Matt Bellany. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So you are coming to us from New York this time because you were at the upfronts. I used to go, and you didn't. Now you're there and I'm not. But this
is when...
You got
the better end of that arrangement, I think.
It may be true. So this is when all these, I used to say networks, it was, you know, began as a broadcast network, would show their upcoming fall schedule, and everybody would be biting their nails with whether their show was on or off that schedule. And they were just trying to wow advertisers with what they had. And now it's, I think it's transformed a lot because the broadcasters, you know, this used to be $8, $9 billion worth of ad money, primarily going to the broadcasters. And now the streamers are in there. I don't know what kind of business they're getting from the advertisers, but I can assure you that they want as much business as they can get.
Yeah, and it's interesting because both Amazon and Netflix are doing their first ever live in-person upfront this year. And it was very interesting to see the contrast. I went to both of them. And Amazon was just a fire hose of shows and news and announcements. And Alicia Keys played. And then Reese Witherspoon came out. Then Will Ferrell. And then Aldous Hodge. And they just had star after star after star. But Netflix didn't really do that. Netflix was much more restrained in theirs. It was smaller. It wasn't in a big hangar. They just focused in on the fact that they are now open for business for advertisers. And that is the big change here, is that Netflix and Amazon were not in the ad game. They are in the ad game, and they want these ad dollars to come from the traditional broadcasters. And I got to say, both of their presentations were really compelling because they give you scale. Netflix's Bella Bajaria stood up there in front of a 500 million number. And that is the number of people they say they reach, because it's 270 million subscribers worldwide. They say with households, that's 500 million. And Amazon did the same. They kept saying, we have 200 million subscribers. And I don't know how many of them are watching the content or watching ads at Amazon, but they do have those numbers. And that is something that the traditional broadcasters can't say.
Another note, Bob Iger was there. He doesn't normally do that. You know, usually the upfronts involve, you know, high-level executives, but not necessarily the CEO of Disney.
No, and they have some good stuff to tout. I mean, it's not like Disney has nothing. I mean, Nielsen put out a new data point the day of the Disney upfront, and it was very positive for Disney because it was a media distributor gauge, which is the total TV usage by media company, not by platform. And that very much benefits Disney because they have ABC, they have Disney Plus, Hulu, etc. And Disney gets 11.5% of viewership, according to Nielsen.
Yeah.
That is above YouTube, which is at 9.6%. And most importantly to Disney, it is way bigger than Netflix, which is at 7.6%. Now, obviously, Netflix only has the one platform, and Netflix has not had sports, so Disney benefits from that. But it shows you that we talk a lot about the scale of Amazon and Netflix, but Disney, when you aggregate it all together, they're not too shabby either.
Disney's a very powerful company. I will just pause. You know, Jimmy Kimmel's upfront jokes. He does these very inside jokes every year. The most anticipated moment, I think, for reporters and advertisers. He had a lot to say, but he did call out Bob Iger, who I just noted was there. He said that Bob had tried to sell ABC and then no one wanted to buy us. This is Jimmy Kimmel talking. And he said, then Bob said he really didn't mean he literally wanted to sell it. And the final thing on that Jimmy said was, you know, Bob, when people test the waters, they usually dip in a toe. They don't drown their children. So the edge was there, as always with Jimmy. He's really great at that. But you mentioned sports, so I will pivot. Netflix had a little surprise for us. And all I can say is, once again, Netflix, with its list of things that it would never, ever do, which it told us in March that they didn't even want to do. No live sports. That's crazy. We don't want to do that. It's too expensive. Well, guess what? Once again, after all the things that Netflix said it wouldn't do, including having advertising, they're not only in live sports, they're accelerating at breakneck speed.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing more live sports than the NFL. It's the biggest sports package in broadcasting. And this is two games they're going to broadcast on Christmas Day this year. They have the right to at least one game in 2025 and 2026 on the holidays. And this is the start. Netflix has
said they had WWE. I mean, yeah, they've been inching along.
That is true. They've done live tennis. They've done live golf, F1.
Yeah, fake tournaments, whatever. Right. Yeah.
But this is one of the big four sports in America. It is football, basketball, baseball, hockey. And this is the biggest of them all. And it makes sense for the NFL to be in business with Netflix. And Netflix has said, we are interested in profits. We're not interested in breaking the bank on a giant package of NFL games. This is a smaller package that they are dipping their toe in with. And I believe eventually they will be the home. For now, yeah. Exactly. And it may take a while, but eventually Netflix will be the home of some pretty significant sports content.
I think the last frontier is a proper theatrical release. And who knows, maybe they'll even eat. That's the final sacred thing.
No, Netflix will have a full season of NFL games before they release movies in theaters.
Oh, I've come to think that they sort of do what they say they wouldn't do for some reason. So we'll see. And finally, I just want to bring up this bundling, which is now getting underway. And it's supposed to make life easier for consumers, to which I say, ha ha, because I'm already confused. We've got Disney with Hulu and Max. And then there's another one that's supposed to be Netflix, Apple, and Peacock. And they haven't told us what that costs. And the issue is, there are these caveats. Like, if you're going to be a consumer and say, I want that bundle, Netflix, Apple, Peacock, you can't get it unless you're a Comcast subscriber, and you cannot get ad-free Netflix.
No, that's the big caveat. I mean, these are marketing relationships, mostly. There is a discount involved, we are told. We don't know what the prices of either of these bundles is. But the Comcast one is really the one with the biggest caveats, because you have to be a broadband subscriber via Comcast to even qualify. And then you got to take the ad tier of Netflix. You know, the big surprise was that Netflix participated in a bundle. But if you look at what Netflix's priorities are right now, the priority is to grow the ad tier. Amazon has more. So they just want to grow. And this is a way for them to potentially grow the ad side.
Yes. Well, as I said earlier, the transformation is underway. I'm finding it dizzying, both as a reporter and as a consumer. So round and round it will go. And at some point, I hope it becomes rational. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Belloni, founding partner of Puck News. Jane Schoenbrunn is not in the business of sacrificing their artistic vision for the sake of financing. The filmmaker poured their own savings into their debut feature, We're All Going to the World's Fair. That movie premiered at Sundance in 2021 and found distribution with Utopia. Now Schoenbrunn is back with a much bigger budget and some very big names backing their second film. The deeply personal I Saw the TV Glow was produced by Emma Stone and her husband, Dave McCary, through their Fruit Tree banner. A24 handled financing and distribution. I Saw the TV Glow explores the nuances of identity. Schoenbrunn drew from their own experience growing up in the suburbs and feeling like they didn't fit in. Early in the film, high schooler Owen, played by Justice Smith, gets to know an older student named Maddie. She quickly tries to warn him that he might be barking up the wrong tree.
I like girls, you know that, right? I'm not into boys.
I wasn't, totally, that's fine.
Okay, I'm just making sure. What about you? Do you like girls?
I don't know.
Boys?
I think that I like TV shows.
You grew up in the suburbs, right? Outside of New York City. And I think one of your themes is that growing up in the suburbs can be very alienating. And I grew up in D.C. and it was, you know, I didn't grow up in the suburbs, but I often thought that would be my feeling about it, that it would just be a little too sterile, a little too like, let's present the perfect picture or whatever. And I kind of like being a little more gritty in the city.
You know, I think that it took me a childhood to figure that out for myself, because I think the weird thing about I think being born anywhere, but especially being born in a place like the suburbs, smack dab in the middle of the 1990s, was that it just felt so normal and everyone was like, this is normal. You know, like I think the entire idea of the suburbs was like to create an artificial normality. I think that, you know, this is like codified in our like white picket fence, bright green grass imagery. But I think there's also like a pretty sinister political aspect to it too, right? Which is like, if the suburbs is normal, like who is excluded from that definition of normality, which seems as much as, if not more, a part of the origin story of the suburbs than like the iconography of the suburbs.
Right.
You know, for me, it doesn't feel weird when you're a kid there. And especially because like so much of the media that I was watching on my TV screen was sort of reflecting back to me this magical mirrored image of the suburbs, you know, like whether that be like a Spielberg film or
Father Knows Best or something. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Or, you know, like, and maybe something even a little bit more sinister, because the suburbs, I think I certainly felt there was something sinister about it from the youngest age, but that was then sort of like repackaged into Are You Afraid of the Dark? Or yeah, like a Stephen King scary story or something. I sort of bought into the idea that like this was childhood, right? And this was like what culture was. And it was really only like once I kind of became a teenager and sort of disappeared into New York City and left that world behind.
Yes. Preparing for the interview and watching the film took me into places that I actually known little or nothing about, one of which is creepypasta. I had never heard that expression before, possibly because I'm a big chicken when it comes to horror and I resist. It's a thing.
It's definitely a thing. Yeah, I didn't know the term either, actually, until somebody told me about it somewhere around 2014. I had definitely been a child of like internet message boards and like a fly to Sherbert about everything that was like creepy and strange on the internet. But my childhood on the internet was like a pre-YouTube childhood, and the like next generation had sort of ran with the desire to sort of like create some weird nooks of the internet and had invented this form, creepypasta, which was sort of all about essentially like conjuring the same energy that you would around a campfire late at night on the internet.
Yeah. You made a film sort of, I don't know if it's adjacent to that or in a little bit of a piece, this film, I think it was called Slender Man, A Self-Induced Hallucination. But I understand that you're sort of off that. I read that you said you have no desire to profit from it, commodify it in a traditional sense.
Yeah, no, I'm incredibly proud of that film. I do view it as sort of like the start of a creative body of work that I've been building since. That film started as like a video inspiration reel for myself as I was working on the film that would eventually become We're All Going to the World's Fair, my first narrative feature. And literally, I was just like trying to interrogate why I was obsessed with this space online that I had discovered. And I was doing that through this sort of evolution of YouTube media about the Slender Man, who was this very iconic export of the creepypasta community, who had just been, you know, there was a documentary about this true crime incident that had happened around him. There was like a narrative feature film that Sony was making. Yeah,
yeah, there was like a Girl Left for Dead or something. I vaguely remember. Yeah,
exactly.
Terrible.
Yeah. And I was like fascinated by it, not only because it like reminded me of my own adolescence on the internet, but it also felt like this fascinating lens with which to interrogate, I think, what my films have been about since, which is the strange relationship between like reality building and fiction, how our world is informed by the fictions we tell ourselves, and those fictions are then in turn informed by the world we live in, and how the internet was changing this process. I've realized that the perfect way to talk about this was just by literally stringing together like a deluge of hundreds of clips from YouTube. Like my voice as the narrator in the film only exists through that curation. And it just didn't feel right to try to profit off of it. So it's not that I disowned the film or anything. I just released it for free on the internet and said, do what you will with this, and kept sort of returning to the themes that that film explored in my work afterwards.
Yes, that's clear. Your first film you mentioned, We're All Going to the World's Fair, also deals with the way people interact with the internet. But I read that you said in an interview that you didn't know you were trans when you started working on the World's Fair film. And I'm just curious, what was that experience like? Was it as you were filming the movie?
So much of, I think, what drew me to making World's Fair was trying to interrogate this feeling that I had had in my teenage years very viscerally. And I think at the time when I was working on the film, I had started to really experience again, which is a experience that I now would use the word dysphoria to describe. Mm-hmm. I don't think I certainly didn't know that word when I was a teenager. And at the time, I'm not sure if I knew the word in 2014 or so when I started work on World's Fair. But I was trying to make work about like why fiction felt like a really safe, but also kind of toxic place to explore identity within. And the real world didn't. And I, of course, was doing exactly that kind of exploration by trying to make my first film. I had so much imposter syndrome and so much fear about trying to be an artist. And I think shame more specifically. And it was through the interrogation of that shame that I think I really did get to my egg crack moment and realize that there actually was a reason and a cause and a name for this sort of sense of unreality or life not being quite right that I had been living within. I think it's actually like very rare and special to find out that there actually like is a solution for an existential problem like that. And certainly that's not the case always in this world. But in this case, like my egg cracked and I set off on the terrifying journey of, you know, essentially like blowing up every aspect of my life as it existed and starting the slow process of rebuilding and becoming somebody else. And that process slowly has led me to myself in a way that I just feel like, to put it in the terminology of my movies, like that I've like stopped being in the audience and have entered the screen, so to speak.
Wow. Were you in the middle of filming when this happened, or where were you?
No, I was working on the final draft of World's Fair after writing for years. And I was at a cabin with some friends from college on a mushrooms trip. And I told myself that on this mushrooms trip, I wanted to explore shame and like why I felt such shame about making my own art, and in a kind of circuitous way. And it took a couple weeks after that. But it led me to some stuff about gender and growing up like really ashamed of my voice. And that led me pretty directly to the egg crack.
Wow. And so you went from she, her at that point to they, them.
No, well, thank you for misgendering me there. I went.
Oh,
from,
I didn't mean to. I'm not.
No. I take it as a compliment. I was born AMAB, which means assigned male at birth.
Okay.
So I went from he, him to she, they. And I went to she, they because I knew that if I didn't give people in my life the option of she, they would just misgender me. So it was almost like a legibility thing, because cis people have a lot of trouble with they, them pronouns because they don't want to practice them. And then I got to a point slowly in transition. I think I always knew that like gender for me was not a straightforward experience of going from like one unstable plane to a more stable fixed identity.
Right.
It's just like too big a mystery for me for that. And I think I always knew that like they, them felt more truthful and like my own experience of gender. But there was a moment there where I was trying to be legible for other folks.
Coming up after the break, Jane Schoenbrunn talks about pouring their savings from working a corporate tech job into making their debut feature, We're All Going to the World's Fair. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes. Join Jacqueline Coley as she hosts a brand new podcast, Seen on the Screen. Meet the innovative people at NBC Universal as they share their journeys, inspirations, and the movies that define them. Each episode is an intimate and fun conversation about the impact of film. Seen on the Screen is available now wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Introducing the KCRW Donation Car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to Jane Schoenbrunn about their second film, the psychological horror drama, I Saw the TV Glow. Years before Schoenbrunn was in a position to win the backing of A24 and producers Emma Stone and Dave McCary, Schoenbrunn was determined to make their first feature, We're Going to the World's Fair, without sacrificing control. How did you finance the World's Fair film?
Well, the first thing that I knew when I was making World's Fair was that the movie, in a worst case scenario, needed to be able to be made for literally nothing. I was like prepared to make that movie on a cell phone if I had to. I think I knew enough, having worked in the film industry for a long, long time, to know that if I made the movie actually for too much money, I wouldn't be able to make it the way I wanted to. It was my first film. And the thing that was most important to me on that film is making something that was creatively free and expressed what I could do as a filmmaker and working in the business. It's very easy for things to get watered down, especially when you're early in your career and don't have a lot of political power. So I knew I wanted to make it for very little. I had worked a corporate tech job for a long time and put some savings into it to get things started. But then all of the rest of the money and the vast majority of our still really tiny budget came from one independent executive producer financier who had just started a company trying to do exactly what I was trying to do, which is make smaller investments in daring art. So I really owe Hannah Dweck and her producing partner, Ted Schaefer, who were investing in the film my entire career. And the freedom that they gave me to make it has certainly set me up to be able to continue making things that I could be proud of.
That's amazing. So your movie, I think it debuted during shutdown Sundance, right? Is that what happened?
Yeah, there was a COVID-inspired virtual Sundance in 2021, and the movie did world premiere during that, yeah.
And I suppose that was great to be in Sundance, but damn it, wish you could have been.
Actually, I think it was all good for me. The movie, like I said, is, you know, like a little bit stranger and slower. I think if it had premiered in like the busyness of a traditional Sundance, it maybe would have been lost in the shuffle a little bit more. Mm. And I also think that virtual Sundance like kind of democratized who got to be watching those movies. And so a lot of younger people, a lot of trans and queer people got to see the movie right from the beginning. And that really helped the movie find its people.
Yes.
And then I think also on a more personal level, at that point, I had been basically transitioning, you know, and I had just changed my name maybe 5 or 6 months earlier. And so in a strange way, quarantine like really helped me have like a little bit of a backstage to hide in during those very vulnerable early months of transition. And since then, Sundance was really like the first time I had been out in public as a trans person. So it was terrifying, but it was also like diving in the deep end a bit.
Right. Well, this film also played Sundance, but in person, we'll call it. I'm sure that was a very different experience. But let me ask you beforehand, how do Emma Stone and her husband, Dave McCary, come in to produce this film with their fruit tree company? I read recently that she wants to be called Emily, but I don't know if the world is ready to make that change. But how did that happen?
Yeah, I think in a funny way, I feel a kinship with celebrities. Not only because, you know, Emily is her real name, so there's already this split identity and name there. But then there's also the fact that, like, you can't really walk down the street without people being weird. That's that's another commonality in the trans experience and what I imagine the experience that Em has in daily life is like. But she's lovely.
Yeah, let me just explain that there was another actress named Emily Stone, and that's why she got dubbed that way.
See, I didn't even know that. She's lovely, and Dave is lovely as well. I had written I Saw the TV Glow early on in my transition, and a few months before Sundance, I think I had written it like right before the film got into Sundance, my first film. And so I had the script, I had this buzzy Sundance premiere, and I think I knew enough to know that I wanted to make an A24 film.
Right.
And that I wanted to take this big leap in terms of scope and budget and ambition and crew. And I knew that like I needed some adults in the room with me. So yeah, my like reps and I did a bunch of outreach and took a bunch of meetings with a bunch of lovely companies. And Em and Dave and Allie and Kevin in their office were the folks that I resonated with most during that process. And I think it was both like a warmth that I felt from them that felt very genuine and not sort of like business dealy. And it was also the fact that Dave and Em are both artists. Dave is a filmmaker and Em obviously is Emma or Emily Stone. And I just trusted them to do the thing that I needed my producers to do, which was to like protect me and protect my vision as I tried to make something very bold and very personal in a commercial landscape.
Yeah, I mean, this sounds like a great thing, but did you have an agent who called their agent or how was the connection made? Not everybody can just do that.
Yeah, I didn't when I went into Sundance, but it was one of my main goals during Sundance to get an agent. I did that job carefully, as I've done every part of the process of sort of like trying to stake a life and career and art making practice for myself in Hollywood. I really wanted to work with somebody out of Sundance. I think a lot of the people who talk to you out of Sundance, reps are chasing heat and aren't thinking long-term necessarily. They're like, okay, this person's going to be buzzed about for the next couple months. So how can I like get some quick money from, getting them TV jobs or something? And I knew that I actually wanted to be like thinking way longer term than that and maybe not even make much money for a while because I really wanted to build this like long-term career as an auteur. And so I was very careful in choosing my reps to choose people who I really felt shared that vision. And then I have a group of agents at CAA, but the person I work with every day is the person who had sold World's Fair at Sundance, who at the time, I don't think rep clients, but I just had a wonderful and like trusting experience with her and knew that she really understood me and my work. And I basically said like, will you be my agent and talk to all the other agents for me so I don't have to? And so together we collaborated and made this list of potential producers. And then they made the phone calls. And I think a lot of people had been tracking me in the film because it had premiered in Sundance. And we slowly took those meetings. And it was cool. I think I did it right to a certain degree because there was enough buzz that at each point of the process, both the choosing the right producer, which we ultimately went with Em and Dave's Fruit Tree, and then selling the film to A24 and making the deal to have it be financed and, distributed by them. Both of these things were like what I guess I've learned in the industry is called like a competitive situation in that multiple people are sort of vying to do it. So you've got some heat behind you and that obviously allows you to negotiate. In my case, that was like very much about like negotiating for creative autonomy.
Right. I read that the first time you talked to Emma Stone or Emily Stone, she said, literally, we have a lot of power and we want to give it to you. And you said, cool, I'll take it. I'm going to need it.
Yeah, that's true. And I really appreciated it. I think that their mindset coming into the process really was exactly that, sort of using the power that I think especially Em had as, a force to be reckoned with in Hollywood to push through some things that maybe could be a little bolder than would be able to get made otherwise.
Yeah. And you, I don't even know if they visited the set or they were just on the phone when they needed to be.
Yeah, they were definitely like, they weren't booking the catering, but they came to set briefly and they were always there for the call that needed to be made when there was something that I needed to call in the big guns for. And through the end of the process, they were really there as exactly that kind of support that they had promised. And it was great. And obviously like tons of other people worked incredibly hard to realize the movie, like so much love and care and manpower went into bringing it to life.
Yeah, it seems like a very, very fortunate confluence of things. Jane Schoenbrunn is the writer and director of I Saw the TV Glow. The film is now in theaters everywhere. Thank you so much for talking to us today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And that's The Business. Joshua Farnham produced and edited today's program with help this week from Nick Lamponi and Mario Saavedra, who mixed the show. You can stream The Business as well as other great KCRW shows on kcrw.com or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business. You're listening to KCRW during our spring fundraiser, and right now we're showing love to the food bank. You can support public radio and fight food insecurity all in one, thanks to our enduring partnerships with local food banks in Los Angeles, Santa Barbara, and most recently, Coachella Valley and Orange County as well. Food insecurity can seem too intimidating to tackle, but you can make a difference. Do it right now by supporting KCRW and send meals to our food bank partners. We've sent more than 2.5 million meals to our food bank partners. Let's get to 3 million. Do it today at kcrw.com/give.
KCRW sponsors include Disney, presenting Young Woman and the Sea, an incredible true story from producer Jerry Bruckheimer and starring Daisy Ridley, now playing in select theaters.
KCRW's car donation program is sponsored by local Kia dealers, introducing the all-new EV6 with a vehicle-to-load function that turns the EV6 into a mobile power source. More info at kia.com.